Okay, so we are at our fourth and final preparatory session. German Jewry, 1933, trying to get a snapshot, if that's possible, of the German Jewish community when Hitler comes to power. So, Hitler comes to power at the end of January 1933. He becomes Chancellor of Germany. The Nazi Party is not the majority in the cabinet at that time. It's through democratic election and coalition politics. But the Nazi Party is the largest party in Germany. And Rabbi Leo Beck, who is the leader of liberal Jewry in Germany at the time and really quite a heroic figure, someone who urged Jews to leave Germany after Hitler comes to power, but himself stays behind as long as there are Jews there. Leo Beck said soon after the Nazis came to power, quote, "The thousand-year history of the German Jews has come to an end," end quote. It's quite a remarkable statement on the part of a community leader talking about their own community and saying, that's it, we've reached the end of the line. And we're not going to discuss the Holocaust in this preparatory session. We will have opportunity to talk about German Jewry and the Holocaust on the trip. But what I wanted to emphasize is that Leo Beck may have been prescient. Most Jews disagreed with him. In 1933. Most Jews did not agree with him. Most Jews felt that Hitler was a passing phenomenon, as the turnover of governments in the Weimar Republic had been so rapid. And one election after another, there was an average of more than one election a year in the last years leading up to the Nazi rise to power. And there was no reason to believe that he would be a prime minister any longer than any of his predecessors, who, again, barely lasted a year in most cases. The thought that he would actually be in power for 12 years, the thought that he would actually implement not only what he said he would do, but going beyond that as well, was something that most Germans, I believe, did not necessarily believe in 1933. In addition, I think that most German Jews felt that anti-Semitism was something that had come and gone. It had waxed and waned in Germany over the last couple of generations. Remember that the Jews of Germany were emancipated in the 1800s, but the final emancipation of all of the German Jews, remember we said there were about 100 different states and principalities, only happens in 1871. So in 1933, you could have remembered, or certainly in your parents' and grandparents' lifetime, there was a time when they were not equal citizens in the country. And so the thought that you might go back to not being equal was actually not so terrifying. It might have been something sad. It might have been something undesirable. But it's not like I say to 21st century American Jews, you might lose equality. You'd say, what? That's the end. Forget it. I'm out. Whereas for German Jews, it would have been a terrible reality to face if they thought that was going to happen. But even that wouldn't have been the end of the world, because after all, our grandparents lived in Germany without equality. Our parents may have lived in Germany without equality, too. Not only that, but the German Jewish community in 1933 was a well-to-do, influential community. They were a very well-organized community. And so they had every confidence that they could defend themselves and defend their rights under the democratic constitution of the Weimar Republic. They could defend themselves in the courts. They could defend themselves using the traditional means of fighting anti-Semitism, to hold on, to negotiate, and to know that it will pass. So who were the German Jews? We've already talked about the thousand-year-plus history of German Jewry. In 1933, we estimate there were about 500,000 Jews living in Germany, about 500,000. They were less than 1% of the total population of the country. Really a very, very small minority. 75% of them were concentrated in the large cities, which was highly disproportionate to the rest of the German population, which meant they were disproportionately urban. A third of them, a full third of them, lived in one city, Berlin. We estimate between 160,000 and 170,000 Jews were living in Berlin in 1933. There were 94 synagogues in Berlin in 1933. And as we'll see, some of them were quite magnificent. 94. This means also that the role of the Jews is going to be magnified in the German economy and German culture and German politics because they are highly urbanized and highly educated. 60% of the Jews were involved, made their living through trade and commerce, meaning anything from a small shop owner to a factory owner to a major industrialist. 25% worked in manual trades, meaning they were craftsmen. They were tailors. They were people who did things with their hands. About 12% of them worked in the professions, like law and medicine. If we're speaking about German culture in 1933, just mentioning two figures, and there are many more that we'll come across when we're on the Germany close-up trip. Just mentioning two figures, Albert Einstein, who won a Nobel Prize in the 1920s and was a very important personality in Germany in 1933, and Sigmund Freud, who was living in Vienna, which again culturally is part of Germany, even though Austria was a separate state at this time. These two people, when Time magazine had a competition for the person of the century at the turn of the millennium, 2000 or at the end of 1999, I don't know how many of you remember this, how many of you were aware of this, but they had the person of the century. They normally have the man of the year or the person of the year. So they had the person of the century. Well, if I remember correctly, Albert Einstein was number one and Sigmund Freud was number two. Both German Jews who lived during this time period, the early 20th century, in Germany or in Austria. I mean, that is quite remarkable. And I have to tell you, from the research I've done in preparation for these sessions and for this trip, I'm actually quite overwhelmed with how this tiny minority, less than 1% of the population, played such a tremendous role in German science and culture and the arts. I mean, just, and the economy, just unbelievable the magnified role they played, which of course is a double-edged sword. Great success in many ways. And on the other hand, great resentment at their success. Religiously, I think that many of us have an impression that German Jews were very assimilated or very acculturated. And there is truth to this. German Jewry was very acculturated. They were German-speaking. By the 20th century, most German Jews did not want to speak Yiddish. They thought Yiddish was, a kind of a denigrated kind of German. They were really fully German-speaking. And we mentioned already that tens of thousands of them converted in the 19th century. That continued to some extent in the early 20th century. And we also mentioned that in 1933, the intermarriage rate was 44% amongst German Jews. So they were very, on the one hand, very integrated into the society. On the other hand, 80% of German Jews considered themselves liberal. And the vast majority of them belonged to synagogues. a much higher percentage than, for example, modern-day American Jewry.
I mean, when you say liberal, they consider themselves under like the Neo-Becks,
right? Yes, exactly, exactly. Liberal as opposed to reform. Okay, liberal Judaism was kind of Masorti Judaism or conservative Judaism, and reform was something a little more to the left, if you like. And there certainly were many Reform Jews too, but the vast majority considered themselves liberal Jews and were synagogue members. Only about 15% of German Jewry considered themselves Orthodox in 1933, which is more or less comparable to American Jewry today. About 60% of German Jews belonged to what was called the CV, the Central Verein, V-E-R-E-I-N, which is the Central Association of German Citizens of the Jewish Faith. Now, this was the largest mass membership Jewish organization in Germany. And what can you tell by the title? Central Association of German Citizens of the Jewish Faith. We are German citizens. We happen to be of the Jewish faith, as opposed to the Catholic or Lutheran faith. Okay? And this organization was sort of like the B'nai B'rith that we may know or may not know in the Anti-Defamation League. In other words, their major role was protecting Jewish rights in Germany, right? Fighting anti-Semitism in Germany. That was their main role. I'm trying to convey to you how affiliated German Jews actually were, that 60% of them belonged to a Jewish organization. I mean, there is nothing like that in America today, nor was there ever in the American Jewish community such a mass membership Jewish organization. Membership meant paying dues. That's what membership meant. Some people might have been more active, some less active, but, you know, if you're willing to pay dues, that means something. This organization was founded in 1893, by the way, to defend the community against rising anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism in Germany is not something new. It's not something Hitler invented. It existed before. Certainly he builds on that anti-Semitic tradition. From 1929 on, which is when the Nazis began to win significant electoral victories, the CV is very active in trying to help form alliances of the left and right in the Weimar government to keep the Nazis out of power, which they succeed in doing for 4 years until 1933. About 30% of German Jews belonged to the Jewish War Veterans Organization. Now, this, of course, overlaps with the 60%. It's not, we haven't reached 90%. This overlaps with the 60%. And that certainly is a group of Jews who are very proud of their German fatherland. I'm reminding you, 100,000 German Jews served in the German army in World War I, which is quite a high percentage. And disproportionately, they were wounded and awarded medals. In the war effort, which is something that the Nazis tried to erase and actually turn on its head and say the Jews not only didn't serve in the war, but they actually stabbed us in the back. And since they're actually such a tiny minority, the average German probably didn't know a Jew and therefore could easily be swayed to say, oh, yeah, maybe they're right, maybe the Jews didn't serve. Only about 10% of German Jews belonged to a Zionist organization in 1933. Now, as Hitler's rule begins, April 1st, 1933, there'll be a boycott of Jewish shops to be followed by legislation restricting Jews from the civil service, restricting Jews from schools, restricting them from various professions. In 1935, the Nuremberg Laws, the Jews lose citizenship in Germany. They are subjects of the Reich. As this progresses, the Zionist movement is going to grow by leaps and bounds. But in 1933, Germany was not a particularly Zionistic community. Lucy Derivitz, in her magnum opus, The War Against the Jews, describes German Jewry in this way. German Jews were generally cosmopolitan, not only in that they lived in cities, but they were quite culturally sophisticated. They were liberal in their religious orientation. They were generally liberal in their politics. There were some Jews who identified with the far left and some Jews who identified with the right, but that generally most Jews voted liberal in their politics. And there were three minorities that stood out amongst German Jews in 1933. And we've mentioned two of them already. The Orthodox, who stand out. The Zionists, who stand out. And last but not least, the Ostjuden. Ostjuden, the Jews from the East. O-S-T-J-U-D-E-N. The Ostjuden, J-U-D-E-N. The Ostjuden were Jews who had come to Germany in the last few decades. With all of the dislocations of World War I and the period that followed that, many Jews, and a lot of heightened anti-Semitism in Eastern Europe, a lot of Jews from Eastern Europe began to move to Germany in the interwar period. These Ostjuden were viewed with some ambivalence by the majority native German Jews. On the one hand, they often helped them. On the other hand, like America's Jews treated the immigrants at the turn of the century, they wanted them to become German as quickly as possible and to lose their greenhorns, as the expression used to be about the immigrants to America. These Ostjuden were disproportionately represented amongst the Orthodox and amongst the Zionists. Why? Because those movements were much more popular in Eastern Europe than they were in Germany. So they brought with them disproportionately Orthodoxy and Zionism. And they were truly outsiders of the mainstream of German Jewish society. And it's not by chance that the first Jews that are going to be victims of the Nazis as a group are the Ostjuden, who were deported in the thousands in the fall of 1938, before Kristallnacht. Kristallnacht, of course, November 9th, 1938, November 9th and 10th, when most of the schools of Germany are destroyed, when thousands of Jewish shops have their plate glass windows destroyed and are looted, when about 30 to 35,000 Jewish men are arrested and sent to concentration camps, certainly a very important turning point amongst German Jews. It's interesting that German Jewry is not quick to leave Germany. On the other hand, the myth that most German Jews remained in Germany is not true. The majority of German Jews did leave Germany before the war began, and therefore the survival rate amongst German Jews, ironically, was higher than amongst Jews, for example, of Poland and Lithuania. In 1933, about 37,000 Jews fled Germany the first year of Hitler's rule. Most of them were socialists and communists who fled not because they were Jews, but who fled because they feared what Hitler would do to the socialists and communists. Most of them went to nearby countries, hoping that Hitler's reign would soon end and they'd be able to return. The numbers in 1934 declined. In other words, the graph is not just one going up and up and up. In fact, from 1933 to 1938, till Kristallnacht, in those 5 years, about 150,000 German Jews leave Germany. Remember, it's not so easy to find a place to go to. The vast majority go to Palestine and make up the Fifth Aliyah. Some go to the United States, some go to Switzerland, some go to neighboring European countries, but many countries are not opening their doors, because the Depression is still around, and they fear that these foreigners will take the jobs that are scarce enough for their own populace. But from Kristallnacht, November 1938, until the war begins, September 1st, 1939, which is less than a year, another 150,000 German Jews leave Germany. The same number is left in the five previous years. Clearly, Kristallnacht is an important turning point. The violence against the Jews, not only their property, but against the many Jews who were killed and many Jews who were wounded and tortured in Kristallnacht, a nationwide pogrom, leads a large number to leave, even though by this point it's harder to get in anywhere, particularly Palestine, where the British are closing the doors to Jewish immigration. Questions? Yes. Were they successful in moving assets out of the country? A very good question. In large part, they were restricted from moving assets out of the country. In the early period, it was easier. But as time goes on, it becomes more difficult. But interestingly enough, the Nazis and the Zionist movement make an arrangement, which was organized by a leading labor Zionist, a young rising star in the socialist Zionist movement by the name of Chaim Arlozorov. There's a street named after him in almost every Israeli city. Chaim Arlozorov negotiated a deal by which German Jews who were going to Palestine could not take out money, but they could buy German manufactured goods, cars, machines, sewing machines, refrigerators, whatever they could buy, and that would be shipped to Palestine, and they would have it there. And that, of course, was for the Nazis a way to increase industrial production. Chaim Arlozorov was assassinated by right-wing Zionists who thought it was wrong to be negotiating with the Nazis. And here you come to one of those terrible ethical dilemmas. On the one hand, this transfer agreement, as it was called, was able to facilitate Jews leaving Germany and ultimately saving Jewish lives. On the other hand, you're negotiating with the devil. One of many very difficult ethical choices of the Holocaust, and this is just one of them. Yes, any other questions? Okay, yes, David. I do not have such a breakdown of denominations of the 94 shuls. My impression is that the largest and the vast majority were liberal and reform.
And liberal was more conservative.
Yes, liberal was closer to the conservative movement that we have today. Excuse me? Positive historical Judaism. Yes, so liberal is an outgrowth of positive historical Judaism of Zacharia Frankel. Okay? Thank you very much.